in the nightclubs, we have found friends, we've lost friends, we've found lovers, we've lost those, we've found relationships and marriages, civil partnerships. We've found ourselves and lost ourselves all over and over again.
Hello and welcome. This is Queer Recollections. It's a podcast where we're exploring and rethinking queer British history. In this episode, I speak with DJ Ritu, a DJ, radio presenter, and club promoter whose mix you can hear right now about her experiences of a vital part of modern queer culture. It's hard to overstate the cultural importance of nightlife for modern queer life. It's a space where new modes of being, new freedoms, new communities are formed, and this has influenced everything from music to fashion to the culture at large. But when we're talking about the history of this topic, two broad issues come to mind. The first is that nightlife often takes place in temporary space with very little left behind, meaning that it's hard to find solid information and trace this history accurately. This allows for the queer and racial origins of club culture to be easily obscured. The other connected issue is the lack of recognition given by mainstream cultural institutions to nightlife as a legitimate place of history, culture, and community. Histories of nightlife deserve a whole series dedicated to them, and the intention here is not to trace them. Instead, I want to explore nightlife scenes that aren't often talked about in the histories of club culture and bring to the fore the community and culture that is so vital to queer nightlife through Ritu's testimony of her involvement in the queer and Asian music scenes. Our story starts in 1986, where she was first employed as a DJ at the London Lesbian and Gay Centre, or the LLGC, which was the first ever council-funded lesbian and gay community centre, which held meeting rooms and a club space.
If we look back to the mid-80s, the climate for anybody like us was very negative, and not particularly welcoming. Even at the LLGC, we used to have police waiting outside to arrest anybody who was coming out of the building for no reason. Homophobic crime was still quite rife. We were in the midst of the HIV and AIDS crisis. It was a time when gay plague was quite a normal tabloid headline, and then in the successive years of the 1980s, Clause 28 and so on and so forth, some of the equality rights that we've won since then, you know, didn't seem remotely possible in the mid 80s. So the disco, you know, it was this tiny entity within all of that scenario that was going on. You know, it took on another level of importance for that reason.
Do you think it's left an impression beyond it closing?
It's kind of got there's a lot of myths surrounding the LLGC. There's kind of a lot of folklore almost, isn't there? But it was the only real time that we had a fully fledged tailor-made community space and a huge community space. And it was the birthing ground for many important organizations that are still around today. It was a really, really important place, and we were very lucky to have it. And I think there is a strong feeling that's been gaining momentum, especially in the last few years, about resurrecting or creating a new version of the LLGC. And I, for one, would very much like to see that happen. You know, in the 90s, that's when we saw our scene become overwhelmingly commercial. and profit driven, and a lot of people get left by the wayside in that kind of you know, that kind of capitalist sort of outlook.
Who are you thinking of specifically?
The people that get left behind.
Yeah.
People without money.
yeah.
That means that people from certain communities and certain cultural backgrounds as well. And if we're looking at gender, I mean, women as well, you know, anybody who's a little bit disadvantaged economically is going to be driven out by something that's largely profit led.
We move on to talk about the clubs and organizations that preceded Club Carly. This is a club that DJ Ritu co-founded in 1995, and at the time it was the first club space that was specifically for the South Asian queer community. She starts by speaking about Asia, which was a club that preceded Carly that opened in North London at the Paradise Club in 1988.
Asia was the first ever LGBTQ world music club, and that was an incredible place, absolutely incredible place. It was a 700 capacity venue split between two floors. The upstairs floor was more kind of techno. And I was brought in to be the Asian music expert, or the Bhangra expert, as Don and Andy, the founders, described it initially. I had almost zero knowledge of Bhangra music when they approached me. But they said, look, we need a DJ who can carry this off and become that expert. And you're the only Asian, you know, South Asian DJ out there that we know of, and who's, you know, from the LGBTQ community. So can you just do it? So I did. And I learned a lot on the spot, is all I can say, over the three years or 4 years that Asia was open. In the same year, the first ever South Asian lesbian and gay organization, Shakti, was created by a guy called Shivananda Khan. And I got very involved with that as well, not just as a DJ, but actually as a management committee member and trying to set up housing groups for young Asians young LGBTQ Asians that were being thrown out of home. In fact, not all of them were young. You know, there was always that homelessness issue for anybody who was LGBTQ back then, as there is now, but more so back then. So we created the Shakti Disco at the London Lesbian and Gay Centre to fundraise for the organisation itself. So these were kind of the forerunners of what then became Club Carly in 1995. And for me, setting up Club Carly was really, I suppose, setting up my own thing, where I would have more control over what I was doing and what kind of club I wanted to create, and how I wanted that place to be for people. And what I wanted was for everyone to feel safe there. That was quite crucial. I wanted people to feel safe if they were South Asian, you know, to be able to wear South Asian clothes and speak in South Asian languages and listen to South Asian music and dance to it. Which quite a few of those people were not feeling in the wider LGBTQ scene. Yeah, again, it was about making something quite bespoke for that, you know, that part of the LGBTQ community. And also, I wanted people who were not South Asian or British Asian to feel absolutely part of this as well, and to share in the music that we knew and loved, you know, to have a different music experience, really. It was about bringing people together from all different communities, culturally, different age groups and genders and so on.
One thing that becomes apparent when I'm talking to DJ Ritu is how integral community is to the clubs that she's been involved in. But how was she able to foster these communities?
You build. You just build on a reputation, I think, especially going back to those times in the 80s and the 90s when, you know, for us, advertising, even in the gay press, was a no-no, because we had to also keep those communities safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Heaven or GAY, they felt safe enough to be able to make sure they were listed in Time Out magazine or in Boys, you know, magazine or Gay Times. And also those magazines were more open to them being listed. I think they were generally more supportive to those kinds of clubs. Whereas with us, A, it was very hard to get a foot in the door. We were experiencing some blockage, shall I put it like that, in terms of being able to get listed or listed correctly. And we just could not put a listing into Time Out or in the 80s in City Limits, because it would be putting our communities at risk, for the risk of attack, whether it was homophobic or based on religion or whatever.
Do you think that's changed at all over the years?
No.
Why do you say that?
It hasn't changed for Club Carly. Our policy is still very much the same. It's quite a protectionist policy, and it's there for very good reason.
Is that because the pressures of racism and homophobia have, you don't think they've lessened over the years, or?
No, they haven't. From our perspective, they haven't. And we feel that our clientele are not only at risk from the wider straight, you know, community. Mm-hmm. We also feel that there's a risk from people within the cultural community as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Carly, up until it closed, you know, during this COVID lockdown period. Right. I mean, we still had a no photography policy in the club, which of course is almost impossible to maintain when people have camera phones. But nevertheless, we still tried to maintain that policy as best as we could. So the only photographs that go up from Club Carly are official. They're taken by our own photographer, and permission has been granted by the people that are being photographed.
Mm. Do you think that has some of the reason to do with why it survived so long?
Yes. And the feedback that we get from people that use Club Carly is very much along those lines. There's some that object to it. They don't want to be kept safe that way. They don't feel the need to be. And they find the policy almost, you know, quite restrictive, I suppose. Mm. But there's a very big percentage of people that don't find it restrictive and are absolutely, utterly grateful for it and reassured by it. And we still find that, I would say, at least 50% of the South Asians that come to Club Carly are not out. They're not out in their community, in their cultural communities. They're not out to their families. They're not out to their employers, et cetera, et cetera. So we are still in a position of protecting anonymity.
I asked DJ Ritu to describe Club Carly in her own words.
So from the minute you enter, you are welcomed. You're welcomed into Club Carly the way that I would welcome someone into my home. It's good old-fashioned South Asian hospitality. In my home, nobody comes here without being offered, you know, food or drink, or, you know, and made to feel like this is their home too. And that's what we've always done at Club Carly. We've done exactly the same thing. Doing this for 25 years, we have gone through generations of Chutney Queens and of Club Carly customers and friends generally. We've watched people grow up there. We've watched people come in from other countries. Literally, they've come from an airport with a suitcase in hand, and they've come straight to Club Carly. We've had people come into the club who start crying because they've never been anywhere like that. They've never been amongst so many people from different backgrounds, from different cultural backgrounds, but specifically the people that are South Asian to come there for the first time and find that they are no longer the only one that they thought they were. But now they're in a room full of, you know, 400 other people like them, like themselves. I mean, it's an incredibly empowering reflection of self, which is still needed by people that feel isolated, that feel alone, that feel like they're dirty or they're wrong or they're alien or they don't fit in with their families. They don't fit in anywhere. You know, it's been like a befriending service, really, in some ways, and a counselling service. We've had people who've been in a corner, self-harming and bleeding, you know, because they felt they could do that at Club Carly, you know, and we've had to take care of those people like that who have been in that kind of state. And it's not just us that's been doing it. We've always worked with partner organisations. So the NARS project, which was again set up by Shivananda Khan, who set up Shakti way back in 1988. Shiv created the NARS project for people with HIV and AIDS who were from certain ethnic minority backgrounds. And that was something that very much needed to happen. People who didn't feel able to use THT or didn't feel as fully understood by Terence Higgins Trust and other bodies that were around. And so the NARS project was created in 1990-ish, 1991, around that time. And then you have the music. So we always used to start the night with slowish music, you know, kind of chilled out Bollywood and music from other sort of genres, and then gradually build up into what became an absolutely storming, heaving dance floor where people would just dance their socks off. We try to encourage the people, the users of the club, to perform. Most of them didn't need any encouragement. They were very happy to get up on the stage again, particularly the Chutney Queens, who would come there in their finery of, you know, colourful saris, which they'd embroidered themselves. Again, the makeup, the jewellery, the wigs, larger than life kind of, you know, personalities, putting them, and then they'd get on stage and usually emulate the dance moves of their favourite Bollywood actress or singers, you know, quite iconic sort of singers and actresses. Mm. And they would carry off these moves, these dance moves, absolutely perfectly. I mean, and again, that was a big contrast that we would see between Club Carly and the straight club that we run, whereby at the straight club, nobody's got the moves that the Carly customers have at all. They just don't have that level of expression and liberation and, you know, desperately wanting to just let it all out, you know. And the other performers that we've always had at Club Carly have been major music stars from the British Asian industry. So we've had, you know, Apache Indian and Bali Sagu and Rishi Rich, and these are quite major names on the British Asian music circuit, and they're internationally known as well. We've had non-Asian people on that stage, like Natasha Atlas, who is, you know, probably one of the best known British Arabic singers. We've had Bollywood choirs that have come in from Pennsylvania University and Bhangra bands and you know, legends basically on that Club Carly stage, and that's been a very interesting experience too. We always wanted to put, at the time when we were earning a good amount from this absolutely packed club, we shoved a load of that money back into paying for these performers who didn't come cheap. So and seeing the experience of those performers was interesting. Some of them were absolutely terrified of about performing at Club Carly. You know, there would be some that would the first time they'd come there, they would literally leap off stage and or run to the back of the stage to get away from the crowd. Some wouldn't use the toilets, for example, because they were worried that they'd get touched up in the toilets by gay men, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they'd go away and think about it, and then they'd be ringing us up to come back. So some of the most frightened straight performers would come back over and over again after having gotten over their initial fear. And what they realized was actually, if they came into this environment and this atmosphere, they would not get booed off stage. There wouldn't be fights breaking out, which is what you get in the straight music scene, and particularly in the straight Asian music scene and at Bhangra gigs. This is pretty common. There will be fights. There will be people who appreciate what you do, but will stand in front of you and just boo you or throw things at you. Mm. And at Club Kali, they just felt the love and realized that nobody was going to try and touch them up in the toilets. You know? So yeah, that's been an amazing thing. So in fact, to some degree, we've challenged, not just in this way, but in many other ways, we've challenged some of the homophobia in the South Asian community and the British Asian community.
I'm interested. What was your pitch with getting these, you know, high profile performers and straight performers as well?
Well, the pitch was always a little bit ropey. So, one of the things I've done is I worked for the BBC for 22 years as a freelance presenter, and I had my own radio show. I had major music artists coming in for interview and live sessions. And I just tried to gauge how many of them would be open and not homophobic enough to be able to perform at Club Kali. I didn't always get this right, I have to say, but generally my gaydar was reasonably good. And if I picked up that I felt that they would be open to performing at Club Kali and that they would not make our customers feel uncomfortable. So that was quite crucial for me. I didn't want people coming there and taking the money and performing and dissing or sneering at the people that were in our club, because ultimately those people came first. I didn't want people coming there and treating it like a zoo. So with most artists, I was very straightforward. I just simply said, by the way, I run Club Kali. And 9 times out of 10, they would say, oh yeah, we've heard about that. That's that gay club, isn't it? The gay Asian club. People all over the country and all over the world knew about Club Kali. So, you know, word had spread very, very quickly. And
That's interesting compared to what you were saying earlier about it being kept purposely secret, but it sounds like maybe it wasn't so secret after all.
No, it was anything but secret. I know. This is where we've always kind of shot ourselves in the foot. So coming back to the performers, yeah, the music artists, the major music artists that used to come in. We did have one Bhangra artist, very, very high profile Bhangra artist at that time. And I just could not quite bring myself to tell him that it was a gay club. I just couldn't. And I had a few...
He did the performance and didn't realise, or...?
He did the performance and halfway through he realised on stage. And this was very apparent. I felt that he was someone who would be able to cope. I felt that he was someone that would not start shouting out "Batty boy" on the mic. I had that confidence in him, and that's why I asked him to perform. But I don't know. I just really had a real stumbling block about being able to actually say. So beforehand, we had a few conversations on the phone, and I said to him, "So listen, Balvinder, it's a kind of alternative sort of club. You know, lots of people that are quite flamboyant and left field, you know, kind of come to Club Carly and he was saying, oh, no problem, Ritu, no problem, it will be fine, you know. Anyway, so there he is on stage at Club Carly on the night. A group of Chutney Queens got on stage with him because if they really, really loved a particular performer, they would get on stage with them and they'd kind of bless them. And this mode of blessing took the form of they would dance next to the performer, right? And actually support their act and what they were doing. So suddenly Balvinda was flanked by four or five Chutney Queens in this packed room with this rapturous audience that were applauding him and so on. And I could see from the DJ booth, all the way at the other end of the room, I saw him. He was in the middle of a high note, and I saw him kind of looking left to right with his eyes. And suddenly something, he had a light bulb moment, and he realized that these were not women. They were men in saris and makeup. And his face changed. It didn't change to anger, but it changed to disbelief of some kind. I don't know. It was a classic moment. It really was a classic moment. And, you know, obviously we spoke later on and he was really fine and chilled. But I kind of felt that he was someone I would not invite back. And we never heard from him again with regard to whether he was coming back. But he did come back to my radio show and no harm was done, shall I say. We also had parents' nights. We held, in fact, only maybe two of these, where we encouraged people to bring their parents to the club to see where it was that they were coming to, because this was a home away from home. For some people, this was the only place they would go to every month. They wouldn't go out anywhere else. And on the first occasion, there were not very many people who could bring their parents. My parents came along. They sat right in front of the DJ booth. And I watched people. And I made an announcement on the microphone to say that my mum and dad were there. And if anyone wanted to say hello to them, that they were situated right near me. And I saw quite a few people come over, some actually asking just for their blessing because they couldn't get that from their own parents. And my mum told me afterwards that when she went into the women's toilet, firstly, she said, oh, by the way, there were a lot of the drag queens in there. Do you allow them into the women's toilet? I said, yes, we do. And so she said, okay, well, they were all very nice. I said, good. And then she also told me that, again, a number of people approached her in the toilets, which was, you know, a quiet area, and just absolutely thanked her for being there. And some were crying, you know, because it really meant a lot to them that anyone's parent would actually even be in the room and kind of give them that acknowledgement that they were okay as people. We went through the growing up process with so many people through Club Carly over 25 years. I mean, I'm still slightly talking about it in past tense, aren't I? Club Carly will be there when COVID has been bashed over the head. So Club Carly is going to be there after 25 years, I think, and I hope. There's still a need for it. But in the time that we have been running, and through these different generations of people coming there, we've seen people fall out with each other. We've seen boyfriends at different corners of the room avoiding each other. We've seen groups of lesbians who will never come back because their ex-lover comes there with her group of friends. And we've seen all of that happen. And unsurprisingly, because, you know, Club Carly is also a space which is about human relationships, as are many nightclub spaces, maybe us more than others, I think. And within that, we have the history of the Chutney Queens. So when we first opened, there was a group that built were coming in from West London, from Southall predominantly. And then there was another group that started to build in Birmingham. It starts with like one or two people, and then gradually they bring friends with them, and then some of these other friends kind of go, do you know what, I really want to express this feminine side of myself, so I'm going to now work on buying a sari and or borrowing one from my mum or my sister when they're not looking, and you know, fiddle about with my makeup and so on in the mirror when they're out and blah. Because another thing we used to do was we used to actually open a little bit earlier for some of the Chutney Queens so that they could get dressed in the toilets at Club Carly or in the space at Club Carly, so that they, because they couldn't do it at home. So some of the queens were married. They had a wife and children back at home, right? And so they'd carry all their clothing and get ready in the club, and then, you know, then de-frock, as it were, after the club finished. So, you know, although we were officially open from, I don't know, 10 p.m. till 3 a.m., really out in terms of the work we were doing, just in the space alone, was more like from 9 p.m. through to 4 a.m. or something. Anyway, so you had these different groups coming in, and I think to some degree there's maybe always been a little bit of competition, one woman upmanship from, you know, with each other, perhaps sometimes trying to outdo each other in terms of who's wearing the most expensive sari or the nicest jewelry, or who's got the best wig, or who's managed to clear the 5 o'clock shadow most effectively. And then there became a slight bit of tribalism regionally as well. So it got to a point after a year that Club Carly had opened, that this rivalry between the Birmingham Queens and the London Queens had built to such a point whereby every time we ran Carly, we were dealing with one queen or another saying, oh, you know, she pulled my wig off, or she bumped me off the stage, or she's doing this, she's doing that. We went through a few bouts of having to ban either individual queens or, in fact, entire groups from certain parts of the UK for a temporary period, on the understanding that when they came back, that this kind of thing could not go on, and they really needed to learn to live with each other and just appreciate each other's queenishness. And then maybe after, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, those queens fizzled out. Most of them stopped queening up. Some transitioned or started to transition a process. And again, that's something we supported people through. And often we were the only port of call where they could get any support of any kind. But, you know, gradually a whole other set of queens started to appear from different parts of the country. And you know, the same rivalries came up again. And they're there now, you know, I mean, with the current set.
We move on to talk about heritage. How can these club spaces be documented and celebrated and remembered properly?
I'm very excited about the idea of an LGBTQ plus museum. An actual physical space which houses a lot of archive material, memories, history. And I don't think we've arrived at that moment whereby I feel that there's an appropriate housing for all of our history, at the very least in the British context.
I don't know about you as well, because I've been thinking a lot about how you should document nightlife and clubbing in a museum context. And I always think like clubbing and heritage, or clubbing and museum, like kind of jar as concepts and words together, and I'm not really sure why that is. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
I think there's definitely ways of doing it, and exciting ways of doing it, and I think if we were to do something that was to do with queer history in the British context, I think it would be so, so fantastic. I mean, in fact, it gives me goosebumps even just thinking about it. Because our history is very rich when it comes to, it's rich in many ways, but it's particularly rich when you think about the fact that a lot of our lives have been built and based within the nightclub industry. Because we've had no other options. Those were amazing times that, you know, we have in the nightclubs, we have found friends, we've lost friends, we've found lovers, we've lost those, we've found relationships and marriages, civil partnerships. We found ourselves and lost ourselves all over and over, over and over again. Maybe that's just my perspective because I've worked in clubs now for 34 years, but I'm sure it's got to be the experience of quite a lot of people that at some point their coming out process, which will have been repeated over and over again, because we make that choice about where we come out, when we come out, you know, so many times in our lives, I think. Everyone's got a backdrop off the queer nightclub scene. It's vital. Yeah. It's been vital to who we are.
Which is why it's so sad when they close down.
Absolutely. But it's not just the LGBTQ venues and events and promotions that have been closing down. It's been happening in the nightclub scene full stop. If I talk to club promoters on the LGBTQ scene and outside of that, on the straight scene that I know in San Francisco or Toronto or New York, they will say the same thing. They've watched that whole scene just get decimated. Some people also put it down to dating apps, you know, the Grindr and Tinder and so on and so forth. Other people put it down to people losing interest in going to clubs, people losing interest in drinking alcohol. You know, that there's just lots and lots of different reasons that have been given. Personally, I don't buy a lot of those other ones. I put it down to austerity and a very extended and long and ongoing recession that we've had, a global recession that we've had for the best part of probably 15 years now. 'Cause we first started to notice this, the effect of this in the clubs that we run way back in 2006, I would say. And that was the feedback we were getting from the security staff that worked on the doors, on our doors as well. They would say to us, say a year ago, clubbers would go out on a Friday night and a Saturday night, and maybe a Sunday or a Thursday, and they said, now we know some people, they're going out once a month or twice a month. They're not going out all weekend. They're not out there larging it the way they used to. And that was to do with people's disposable income, lack of disposable income. And when we're looking at venues specifically, then we have the problem with property and how that's brought up and you know, property developers waiting to just literally swoop like vultures on any venue that can't afford to survive in a recessionary climate. I think after we get this, somebody invents a goddamn vaccine for coronavirus that works, or a cure, I think people will be very desperate to get back out there and be with other people and hopefully actually appreciate how lucky we were to have that opportunity to bond with our fellow humans in lots of different settings. And what could be better than bonding with your fellow humans in a place where you're surrounded by music and the love that brings, the special emotions that music brings on. It's different to bonding with people at Sainsbury's. We don't bond with people at Sainsbury's, right? Whereas we do bond with people in a concert setting. We bond with people in a nightclub. That's very precious to have that opportunity to do that.
I'm not sure about you, but hearing DJ Ritsu speak makes me really miss dancing and being amongst people and music, especially at the moment when we're looking down the barrel of not being able to go out properly for some time. So I hope you enjoyed her recollections. Please do rate and subscribe. And until next time, I'm Will, and this has been Queer Recollections.